From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host, Jay Burke. This morning, we speak with National Geographic's Adventure of the Year, Mike Lebecki. He'll come to Park City live at the Eccles Center as part of the Park City Institute Winter Series this coming Friday, March 22nd at 7 p.m. He'll tell the story of passion and purpose as he has traversed the globe on over 85 expeditions. He encourages families to come and says there's something for everyone. And then in the second half, New York Times bestselling author Eric Blem will tell the story of Craig Kelly, the legendary snowboarder who changed the trajectory of snowboarding in the 80s and 90s and beyond in his new book, The Darkest White, A Mountain Legend and the Avalanche That Took Him. That's all coming up this hour on The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Jay Burke.
Our next guest is National Geographic's Adventurer of the Year. Mike Lebecki defines himself in two ways. He's an explorer. He's obsessed with climbing the world's most remote and untouched mountains, knocking off several first ascents every year. And he's also a dedicated father of an equally adventurous daughter, Liliana, who wants to save the world. Now, Mike has summited from Afghanistan to Antarctica, from Greenland to Guyana, and everywhere in between, paddling with polar bears and climbing the highest peak of Antarctica on what he and his daughter call joyaneering expeditions. We're so pleased to talk to him. Coming up on Friday evening at the Eccles Center here in Park City, Mike will visit our community and tell you more, but we wanted to give you just a little teaser. So good morning to you, Mike Lebecki. Thanks for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Well, good morning and nice to see you both. And thanks for having me on. I'm really excited to chat for a bit this morning. And I'm on my second espresso. So it's an exciting
good.
Time.
Well, that will work. Well, what is joyaneering, first of all?
Well, joyaneering, if you think engineering or mountaineering, think of joyaneering. So it's kind of the act and pursuit of passion of joy. And actually, my daughter came up with that when she was 12, because we had, when she was 12 years old, we had just climbed Mount Kilimanjaro together. And we did a give back project doing solar panels and equipment in orphanages and schools in Africa. And she kind of came up with, this is the act of joy, Dad, and this is joyaneering. And I really love that she came up with that, because joyaneering, I think we should all be joyaneers and get after joy in this human experience.
Oh, absolutely. I love that too. How fun to have a daughter like Liliana, who is so passionate also about her, you know, adventure projects. Now, will she be coming with you on... I mean, I'm sure she'll be there in the audience, but will she also be presenting on Friday night?
She will be there. She might make a few comments here and there, but she will be there with me. So fortunately, she is in town. So it'll be fun to have her there.
Well, Mike, you are the National Geographic Adventurer of the Year. And I mean, I'm curious about a few things, but number one, first, tell us a little bit about what that title means.
You know, I mean, that's one of the fancy titles that I get with, and basically it's just sort of an obsession to adventure, you know, and an obsession for adventure and an addiction to adventure. And so, you know, National Geographic Explorer Adventure of the Year just means I found something that I'm very passionate about. And my entire adult life has been adventuring the world. And, you know, the best part about that title is being out in the field, being able to experience the magic and power and beauty of our planet. The second best part of that is bringing the stories home. And, you know, places that people aren't going to get to go to and experience for themselves. If I can bring those stories back home and share them with other people, to continue the love and passion to take care of our planet, then it's a special thing. So But yeah, it just means I'm obsessed. I'm addicted to and in love with our planet and the people, and want to experience this human life at a high level.
So, two-part question that ties into that is, as you know, the adventurer of the year through National Geographic, I mean, do you work for them per se, or is that a sponsorship? And then, you know, furthermore, how do you fund these expeditions on top of that?
Yeah, so National Geographic, first of all, is an honor and a privilege to work with them, because some of the nicest people, but just teamwork. I think we all know everything in life comes down to teamwork, and having such a high level team is incredible. I got invited to, excuse me, I got invited to do a project with them in 2008. And the head of the Expeditions Council basically said, hey, we're going to give you a chance to get in the door with us, because we've got a lot of amazing projects and we've been seeing what you're doing. And the project went really well. And then I got a magazine article and a TV show and a grant. And that kind of gets you in the door as a Nat Geo explorer. So again, a lot of hard work, but just an honor and a privilege to work with them. And so I do contract projects. I get assignments. I speak for them all over the world, you know, doing different stuff all the time. So
if you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with National Geographic Adventurer of the Year, Mike Lebecki. He's coming to Park City on Friday. He'll be on the main stage at the Eccles Center. It's from 7 to 9 p.m. That's part of Park City Institute's presentations. And we're really excited to be talking with him to just preview a bit about who he is and what he'll be bringing to Park City on Friday night. That's in 2 days. Still have time to plan. We like to do things very last minute here in Park City because, you know, there's always the got a better offer potential. So this is sounding to me like the got a better offer thing to do on Friday night, Mike. So, you know, one of the things that I would imagine, if you're a National Geographic Adventurer of the Year, you are supplied with the photographers and the videographers that are really among the best in the world. I mean, what an honor it would be to be a photographer for National Geographic. So when you go and do your expeditions, I'm imagining a huge team, and this results in, you know, lots of photographs that you'll be showing on Friday night.
Yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, you know, the best part is being out there. The second best part is bringing these stories home. And that teamwork, high level teamwork. One of the bonuses of this is I'm going out with some of my very best friends, photographers, videographers, writers. And to go out there with a team is one thing. To go out there with your best friends and experience that together, the dynamics for that project and the goal, the final product is at such a higher level because you're with there with your friends, you're laughing, you're getting along, you're you know, working through problems and challenges together. And it's, you know, out in the field for 2 months in Antarctica can be pretty intense and emotional, and you can get homesick and you've got to make choices. And, you know, if you make a mistake, you're not coming home. So you can get out there and you've got this team to work out, and it's kind of a big equation to work out for the final product. But, and, you know, imagine an argument with a partner. Next thing you know, you're hugging it out and you're closer the next day. I mean, it's behind the scenes is, you know, gets really emotional and really challenging. But gosh, we have so much fun out there. I mean, it's like being professional children. We just sort of pinch ourselves. How did we get this lifestyle? You know, I mean, but I do want to say, you know, you mentioned, yep, I'm going to be there in Park City on Friday. I really hope people can come out because I'm going to be sharing stories that, you know, these are not online. These are stories that don't exist online. These are personal stories. It's emotional. There's laughter, there's sadness, there's maybe anger, because we're talking about real issues on this planet with polar bears, with climate change, with microplastics. So there's going to be some beautiful moments, but there's also going to be some topics that I really want to share with everyone because, you know, most of this point is, how are we taking care of our planet? what are we doing to make the world a better place? How are we giving back to our global community? And there's some topics there that are really important to me. And knowing a lot of people in Park City, I think these topics are really important to the community there.
Yeah, that was one of the things that struck me. I think I saw a TED talk that you did. And yeah, it's not just enough to go out and have adventure for the sake of adventure. Now there's this other layer that's added to it that's about, you know, what are you bringing back? How are you making the world a better place? And even, you know, a lot of, you know, scientific sort of data collection on, as you said, microplastics. I heard about one of those studies. And this is also what your daughter Liliana has pushed. It's great because it's like this whole generation of kids growing up, they know that there's more that needs to be done, right?
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. So bring your kids to the show. You know, get the families out and come to the show. And I really encourage that because my daughter has such a huge inspiration to say, Dad, you know, these trips, these adventures are really cool. What are we doing to give back? And she's really adamant about that. And that really was a big inspiration to me and so many, because you're right. It used to be going on these big expeditions and climbing these first ascents and, you know, they're wonderful, but what is the, you know, what's the give back component, you know, and that it's changed and evolved. I think that, you know, is, you know, how can we make the world a better place while doing these adventures? Because it is a selfish lifestyle to go climbing and climbing and climbing. And you probably know all these skiers and climbers and it, hey, you know, we're having fun and we do need to have fun. But I think 51% of it is how can we have intention and effort to do something good while we're adventuring and while we're enjoying this life?
Well, on the topic of kids, an overwhelming theme within your expeditions and adventures is this high stoke level. And I think that's certainly a message, you know, worth sharing with our youth and what you can find out there. I mean, how do you keep that fire stoked? I mean, you've done 80 pretty major expeditions now with the goal of 100. I mean, how do you keep that stoke out there when you are having that deep conversation with your traveling partner, you know, or your expedition partners?
Yeah, you know, I think I call it organic enthusiasm. So somehow I found a gift that I absolutely love to do this stuff. But I think we all know in some capacity, when you get up and you go skiing or hiking or biking, you get outdoors and you feel that feeling, you know, just being in the moment of now, and you get off your phone, you get off, you know, watching a show. I mean, when you get out in nature, I think we just have to keep at it, you know, and every time I go out, I think most of us, you just feel good. And it's just seeking that moment of right now where, you know, you're not thinking about the past or the future, in nature, doing something, anything, taking a walk. I mean, it's, I think more than ever, we really need to try to instill that into our kids and younger generations of, hey, you know, it's a different sign of the times, but we've got to stay out in nature. You know, we've got to get out and breathe the fresh air. And you know, there are two rules I had for my daughter as she was growing up. I'm like, you have to ski and you have to play an instrument. And so there's just, don't even try to debate everything else. Do what you got to do, but you got to go skiing. And so that was just, you know, when you wake up at 7 a.m. on a Saturday and say, hey, we're going skiing, and maybe it's not in the best mood. Next thing you know, an hour and a half later, it's like, loving life, you know, thanks for getting me up and going skiing. And now one of our favorite things together is just going skiing. So any activity outdoors, doesn't matter what it is. I think we just all need to get out there and be outside, you know.
Great message to share. So give us a little teaser here. I mean, I've, you know, 80 expeditions. Maybe like give us the scary, not scary necessarily, but a close call. I mean, when you're out there wandering around, I mean, you bounce into animals. Wild animals. you know, tell, I want to, you know, you obviously I've seen you paddling with polar bears, and so give us one. Give us a little teaser.
You know, back to the teamwork and you know, doing these presentations and done these for a long time, and again, being redundant here, but sharing these stories is so important to me. But it is called Paddling with Polar Bears. So there are going to be some intense stories and moments, and it's much more than just polar bears, but it's just kind of a fun running title. But we are even going to talk about climate and evidence that I have, experiences that I have that, you know, sometimes it gets really emotional for me on stage to talk about some of the things I've seen. And so there's going to be, I mean, and I'm FYI, I have edited it, so it will be rated PG. I've been asked to make sure it's family friendly, but I will be insinuating and talking about things that are really emotional, and making sure that it is friendly for everyone to see, FYI. But we're going to talk about polar bears, and it's emotional, and there's some things going on with them. They have some big challenges, and polar bears are on the endangered species list. And I've been on dozens of expeditions in the Arctic in the wild with wild polar bears that haven't seen humans before, and we're going to talk about that. But also climbing and, you know, things about teamwork and trust and, you know, kind of parallel commonalities to everyday life that these expeditions have taught me and my partners and the people I work with. So there's going to be some really fun stuff to share. And I just feel so grateful to get to share these stories, because I do think people appreciate that, gosh, all these places I'm going, there's very few people that go. And to be able to experience those together and talk about issues with our planet, I think that's a special time of being in the moment of now. You know, we're all together having discussions and doing this. So I'm really excited to come hang out in Park City.
Mm. Well, again, Mike Lebecki will be at the Eccles Center here in Park City on Kearns Boulevard Friday, 2 days from now, March 22nd, from 7 to 9 p.m. You can look for tickets online, Park City Institute. And Mike, you know, Park City Institute brings a lot of great speakers. And when I go and listen, sit and listen, no matter who it is, you know, it's a well-chosen person to sort of inspire us and inform us and make us leave. You know, I've walked out of that theater before in tears, you know, like a handful of times, because I'm so moved by what the person's saying on stage. And, you know, from what you've said already, that's what it sounds like you'll be doing. And, you know, there's this thing that people say about you, a lot of your teammates or however you call them, that you're really humble. But on the other hand, you have all of these great, you don't quote other people, you quote yourself. And you kind of said one of them, which is the time is now. And I love it. It's part of that stoke, as Jay calls it. So tell us a little bit about, you know, the self-talk and the talk you do to your teammates out there.
Well, we'll just go right into the time is now. And you know, I had a amazing grandmother growing up, and my brothers and I spent a lot of time with my grandmother. Both of my parents worked, so we spent a lot of time with her. And, you know, she would consistently say, the time is now. And I just so much more appreciate that, you know, growing up and understanding that the time is now and to be in the present. She also gets credit for the quote, why ration passion? And, you know, why ration your passion? But, you know, it's interesting, because she would explain that she didn't have the opportunity to do things that we do today in our generations. And she worked on a farm with 14 brothers and sisters. And if they didn't farm, they didn't eat. And so she kind of instilled in, you know, I didn't have these opportunities. You're in a situation that you can pursue any passion you want. And so she instilled a lot of, and I'm going to talk about her and family and history, explorers. There's all kinds of stuff coming up in the show that have inspired me to try to live a healthy, happy life. And I want to share some of the things I've learned and experienced along the way that I feel are very powerful. But I want to encourage again, families to come, because my daughter's going to be there. Some of the projects she's been involved in, I'm going to be sharing. There's a lot of special stuff that I'm just really honored to be able to share. It does come back to teamwork. I want to share the teamwork of what's going on out there. And some people will probably question my mentality. Hey, is this guy sane? What's going on here? But you know, we're all humans, and we all have a different path. I just feel gratitude to do this stuff and to be able to hang out with such great people and share these stories. So,
well, come to the Eccles Center on Kearns Boulevard here in Park City on Friday night to hear more about Mike Lebecki's path and what inspires him. And you'll walk out of that theater inspired yourself. Mike, thank you so much for joining us today on The Mountain Life, and we'll look forward to seeing you on Friday.
Well, thanks for having me, and your time and energy is very much appreciated, and really looking forward to it.
Thanks, Mike.
Hey, thank you.
Again, that was National Geographic's Adventurer of the Year, Mike Lebecki. You can go to parkcityinstitute.org for tickets. He'll be there Friday night, the day after tomorrow. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Jay Burke.
Our next guest is New York Times bestselling author Eric Blem, who tells the story of legendary snowboarder Craig Kelly, who died in an avalanche in British Columbia in 2003. Craig Kelly transformed the snowboarding world, and his story also parallels the history of snowboarding. Then his death is the story of avalanche, of decisions in the backcountry. Eric Blem joins us today to tell those stories and also the stories in between about this legend, Craig Kelly. It's all in his new book, The Darkest White, A Mountain Legend and the Avalanche That Took Him. Eric Blem, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Lynn and Jay, thanks so much for having me. I'm excited.
Jay and I have just been going back and forth about how much we love your book, and you're a wonderful writer. And I just have to start with the title that just jumped out to me, The Darkest White. I've never been covered by an avalanche, but I'm assuming that dark is what encapsulates you as you get covered by that very otherwise white snow. What a title.
Yeah, it's metaphorical. A lot of people have asked me questions about it. Like, is it the white whale, you know, the Herman Melville style, you know, chasing that white whale, the powder, the snow? Is it dark versus light, evil versus, you know, the siren of the powder that beckons all of us? The truth behind the story of the title is that my very first published article ever was in Powder Magazine back in 1992 about an avalanche. And they titled it, Rob Story and Steve Casimiro titled it The Darkest White. And I've been so intrigued by it ever since. And when Craig passed away and I decided to do this, he was such a shining light, and it was such the darkest day at the time, I think, in snowboarding's history. And it all just came together with that beautiful photograph that we were able to put on the cover.
So you knew Craig Kelly, you had snowboarded with him. So not only are you a New York Times bestselling author, but you're also a snowboarder yourself, and you had a lot of experience with Craig. Can you just quickly go through that?
Yeah, no, I mean, snowboarding gave me a path in life. I wanted to be a pro snowboarder in the 80s. I ski bummed in Breckenridge in the era, the mid to late 80s, when that was a place to go. And ultimately realized I wasn't going to be Craig Kelly, who was like, you know, for your listeners, he was like the Shaun White of snowboarding of that era. He was the Michael Jordan of snowboarding. And injury caused me to kind of reevaluate all that. I'd met a travel rider on a chairlift who kind of intrigued me, and that made me understand, wow, you can live this world and go do these great adventures and write about it. And that took me to a degree in journalism, and ultimately to Transworld Snowboarding Magazine, which I got to meet Craig, and at that point got to travel the world with my heroes, including Craig. And we were both drawn to the backcountry. He was very cerebral and very smart individual, loved to read. And so, interestingly enough, the topics that we often spoke about when you're, you know, sharing a hut or whatever was, what are you reading? And we would trade books. And really fortunate to Craig. I consider him a hero of mine at first, and ultimately a friend and travel companion, and just a great influence to the sport of snowboarding.
I've dove into this book. I mean, it really is just fantastic and well written. And I've already started hitting up friends of mine that I know would really enjoy this. So highly recommend it. But you know, I've noticed it's kind of pulled into a few different parts, and like a really big part of this at the beginning of the book is the history of snowboarding, which I think a lot of our listeners will love this part of the book, but that weaves in Craig's story too. But there's so many fun pieces to this, like the Sims Burton battle and, you know, Craig's role in that, and you know, names that been around, you know, Sean Palmer and, you know, some of the who transitioned into mountain bike. So talk a little bit about where all that history came from and how you dove into it. I mean, just so much depth in there that it's incredible to read.
You know, I luckily can actually say, you know, you always want to say, you know, how did you learn all this or what was that all about? And I can say, well, I actually lived it. And I can say that with all, you know, honesty. But I also was like, you know, magazines were the history books of the sport. That was where we met our influencers of the day. And I think that a lot of the book is an homage to magazines, and I quote a lot of different magazines that came out. You know, this was the era when we would wait at the mailbox knowing the day of the week that new issue was going to show up and huddle around it and read every page and every advertisement. And that was our connection to that world, whatever it might've been, surfing, BMX. And, I just thought what was great, there's been little history books of that show, you know, the snippets of snowboarding history. There's been biographies, and there's been stories of avalanches, but there's never been something that's brought all of that together where you could weave and follow the thread line of someone's life through that history of snowboarding. Literally, I was able to track the right to the very first board and what influenced that first board Craig ever rode back to Christmas morning 1965 and Sherman Poppin making the very first snurfer, to those boards influencing Jake Burton Carpenter in Londonderry, Vermont, who then shipped them to a little bike shop where Craig was a BMX racer in Mount Vernon, Washington, and then Craig ultimately got to try that board. So those were a snippet of the weaving that I was able to do, and to find out that Craig was born to literally 2 weeks exactly after Sherman Poppin was able to apply for the patent. And so he really did kind of prophetically say that it was going to influence, you know, or it had to do with surfing and or skateboarding on snow. And he had no idea. He was basically defining a whole generation, many of whom hadn't been born yet. But then Craig was born 2 weeks later. So he became again the original superstar, the original professional that a lot of people that are listening have probably never heard of him. But you know, he was our co-pilot, so to speak. Craig Kelly was our co-pilot away and became the spirit that kind of oversaw us all. He was always a guiding light. He was a compass pointing the way.
So who really was then the first developer of the snowboard? Like, it's, I mean, there's back and forth, and you mentioned Snurfer, of which you know, is kind of made a comeback here recently. It was actually in Utah for a little bit, and I think they've now gone back east. Sidebar, but was it truly Snurfer in 1965? Is that correct?
I don't think there's anybody that can doubt that was the beginning of the commercial snowboard. He was what brought it to the masses. You know, a million were made and sold throughout a, you know, period between 1966 and like 1978. So commercially, yes, but then it gets really muddy. And the history gets really muddy. I mean, people back, you know, Norwegians and people, you know, way back in time, Turkey, you know, 1800, there's, you know, who stood on a plank of wood sideways and slipped down the snow? Who could ever tell? Tom Sims always said that he made the ski board is what he called it, which is skateboarding on snow, in 1963, and would often say he was the first person. That became a huge point of contention between Jake Burton and Tom Sims, and I cover that as well. So again, it does get muddy, and that's why I knew, being this is a story about Craig Kelly, I was going to focus on what was the very first snowboard, what were the influences that led to his first snowboarder, and I could define that absolutely, and so that's why I started where I did. But there is kind of some conjecture there, and it's a polarizing topic among, you know, snowboarding historians.
Yeah. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Eric Blem. He's the author of a new book called The Darkest White, A Mountain Legend and the Avalanche That Took Him. And we're speaking about the legendary Craig Kelly. So, Eric, what I find so interesting about someone like Craig Kelly is he was many things. Like you said, he was so smart, and you talked about what books you were reading when you were in a hut together. But he started off as a latchkey kid. You know, he's born in 1966. His parents were divorced. They had no money. He had to work like crazy to meet his dad halfway to buy even a pair of Levi's versus, you know, Sears Tough Skins or whatever they were called.
Tough Skins. Wow. Yes.
The Tough Skins are terrible.
Yeah, that's what I remember him because that's what my brother had to wear. So the story of him and that he got so close to getting an engineering degree at University of Washington, straight A's, but he was strategic. And so how was he strategic and how did it form how he went about things?
He had this amazing, intuition or knack. First of all, he knew if something was going to get done, he was going to have to make it happen himself. And that was really, you know, he never held it against his parents, for instance, that he did have to work like he did. And the independence, you know, some people would call it forced independence. Some of his neighbors' parents would call it neglect. And it was really, but he was okay with that. He understood at a young age what it took. And he just had this an uncanny sense of planning ahead. And he also had a knack for understanding what was coming in the future. And I think when he realized how much fun he had on a snowboard, in the mountains, in the backcountry, riding powder, he just knew it was special. He went to get a degree in chemical engineering because he, you know, one of his neighbors said, you know, I think one of the big reasons he didn't want to be poor anymore. Another reason though was that he was very smart and he loved to exercise his mind. And when he got to this point where he was competing some and making a little bit of money, he added it all up and he realized his starting salary as an engineer was going to be this amount. And then he looked at what he was able to win when in little small contests without even training. And he just balanced it out in his head and he realized, wow, if I actually train and snowboarding continues to go forward like it is and build, I could make almost as much, you know, doing this as I will sitting at a desk for a year if I'm really good at it. And he trusted his own abilities to train. And he said, you know, yeah, I'm going to do this. I'm going to quit. And he basically told his dad, you know, what do you think? And his dad knew him as a person. He said, I'll do all I can to support it. Go for it. And he just, you know, ultimately the craziest thing, I think what makes it so cool is that he walked away from this degree and a career that would have started him with a lot of money to try as a professional in a sport that didn't exist. And I mean, not long when he won his first event in Breckenridge, his fourth world championship. I actually have a snippet that I took from a local TV show, and the guy was talking about the event, and then his like final words in the snippet was like NBC Denver sportscaster said, "Yeah, it's a lot of fun, but no one ever going to make any money in real money in snowboarding," and it's pretty funny. But Craig knew, and he knew about a lot of angles in the sport and where it was going to go. And Jake Burton actually said he wasn't so sure if Craig was either making the future or predicting the future, or he was creating it, you know, along the way.
Exactly. The creating the future. I mean, that's what it feels like to me is, as I read through your book, I mean, it starts off with, you know, snowboarders in the early days were running gates. And then Craig Kelly was sort of in that transition into the half pipe, which wasn't even as, you know, we look at Park City Mountain and that half pipe, the super pipe there, it looked nothing like that. So how did he kind of, you know, he was always leaving how things were done one way and creating a new way. How did he, you know, talk about that a little bit?
Well, again, the racing, he kind of felt that the snowboard contest kind of emulated the early skateboarding contest. They'd actually do slalom racing and skateboarding, and they do these snake runs in the parks. And then they started doing these half pipes. And I think Craig, what he did is he would look and he would notice, hey, all the photographers wanted to hang out at the half pipe and catch, you know, the photos of the riders catching air. And, you know, how many great photos can you get in, you know, watching somebody carve around a gate or bashing a gate. And that's when we kind of looked at it and said, hey, where's all the photographers and filmmakers? And don't forget, this is the era of magazines where, you know, cover photos made careers. And that's when he, you know, that, and also just his overall love of it. He liked, you know, catching air, and it was most emulated its own sport. And he ultimately told Jake, he said, yeah, racing is great for skiing, but it really isn't, you know, bashing gates isn't why I fell in love with this sport. Yeah. And that led him to the half pipe. And then ultimately to step back to just the overall riding, free riding was what he became known as, the father of free riding, or riding the whole mountain. And he said, that's the type of riding that I want to do. That's what captured me. That's what made me stoked. That's what would make a kid want to go out and buy a snowboard, the average kid. And he jumped back and even further and said, hey, what does everybody want to do when they're done with their race? They want to go free ride.
Well, that's a good segue into the backcountry. And, you know, and reading through the book, I mean, it's really cool. Like the Canadian mountain guides have such an arduous journey, if you will, to get to the point of actually being a guide. And a lot of this book goes into the end, you know, where Craig was inevitably taken by an avalanche. But, you know, I think I read something that said the Durand Glacier accident it changed backcountry culture forever. I mean, why did that particular incident, was it the pure number of people involved, or, you know, how did that go that direction?
I think that was a quote that was from the Canadian big newspaper, The Globe and Mail, I believe is where that was quoted from. And when I talk to guides today, and even back then, it was such a polarizing topic. And 10 days later, after Craig's avalanche, there was another event in the same range in the Selkirks where some school kids were essentially broadsided by a random event in a very well-traveled area, which was much different than the situation at Selkirk Mountain Experience with Rudy Beglinger and his assistant guide, Ken Wiley, where they were highly trained individuals guiding a paid group. And that was where the questions really came up and the tough questions occurred. And that's one of the reasons I ultimately got into it. I think it changed backcountry culture in the way forever. And one reason was because Rudy Beglinger was such a renowned mountain guide. He'd been at Selkirk Mountain Experience, a helicopter in, ski touring lodge, and or split boarding ultimately lodge, and had never had a serious injury, never had an avalanche fatality. You know, granted, there are lots of resorts and guides that have had that same record. But again, this was a guy who knew what he was doing. And somehow this huge avalanche was able to capture 21 people with a assistant guide who was also a certified by the Canadian Avalanche, or I'm sorry, the Association of Canadian Mountain Guides certification assistant ski guide, which is a huge process in itself. Yeah. So how did this happen? It really made people take a look at everything from avalanche forecasting to the tests that are involved to evaluate conditions, the human factor, group management, all the way around. It really made everybody step back and take a look at guiding and those tough questions in the backcountry.
Talk a little bit about Rudy and his involvement in the incident. He was a part of a business. He is a business. And how much do you go into that and like that human factor aspect? He's going to push forward and get people on the powder. That right. Is our crack, right? I mean, we want to get to that powder at any cost, and I paid to get there, get me there. You know, was that a big factor in this? I mean, don't give away too much. I mean, I haven't gotten right to the end of the book yet, but
yeah. I mean, Craig being an engineer and someone who would look at avalanche accidents during his own training to become a mountain guide, that's what he was doing. He was on a practicum or apprenticeship, as we say in the U.S., as part of his training with Rudy. And I will say that I think that overall, I reverse engineered the whole thing in part to honor Craig, but also all of them, because there were these so many questions that weren't answered. And so to answer your question without giving the answer, I go very deep into all of it. As a journalist, I've always kept myself out of my own books forever. And in this case, you know, my editor ultimately said, "You knew Craig, you know this world." I was certified as level one avalanche, Canadian Avalanche Association, in December of 95, which was when Craig first took his course, reshadowed our course actually. Mm-hmm. And then turned around and took his own course in 96. So I know the world, I know the people, I know the personalities. And I just felt like I want to dive in and really get into it. And ultimately, almost all of the survivors that were involved spoke to me. And most of the responders spoke to me. And then I also dug into all the records of the tests that Rudy had done. And again, I reverse engineered the whole thing to kind of get at those questions that you're talking about. And there is a, you know, it goes as deep as some people would say that Rudy, it was all about ego and this egotistical guide who was, an animal in pushing people. And other people would say he was just a jerk to work for. But then I interviewed a lot of his past employees and got a real humanistic look at all the characters in the book. And, you know, some people might not agree with him. Thus far, I will say that the people who have responded to me in that world have said, good job. It's a tough read. It's going to be hard for some people to read it, but you nailed it. And I couldn't ask for more than that.
Mm, that's nice. Well, Craig died on the Durand Glacier near Revelstoke in the Selkirks. And for anyone who's ever, you know, come from the U.S. to ski in the Canadian mountains, first of all, you know that to become a Canadian mountain guide is so stringent. In fact, I don't know, I've heard people say that even more stringent maybe than those European alpine guides, but can you make that distinction and tell us how exactly what it takes to become a mountain guide, which was what Craig Kelly was pursuing?
Well, there's two paths that you could take, and he had that option as well. There's the Canadian Ski Guide Association, which focuses on mechanized guides who guide downhill, at least at the time, more for helicopter and catboarding operations. And then there's the Association of Canadian Mountain Guides, which is more the traditional alpine guides, rock climbing guides that then got into training ski guides. And in a nutshell, even to get into the program, you have so many the list that I tick off in there of all the types of trips that you've had to do on your own just to be accepted into the course. And at the time, Craig was on a split board. He wanted to lead the way and break down some walls for split boarders that we all know about now. And I'm assuming that most of your listeners do, but it's where you split a snowboard down the center. It becomes two separate touring skis, and then you can connect it back together and you're snowboarding downhill. And they didn't want anything to do with snowboarders on split boards at the time. So Craig was the first to ever be accepted. To be accepted into the course, you had to have like 50 days of snow pit analysis, records. You had to have multiple overnight guided or trips in glaciated terrain. You had to spend at least 3 years of snowboarding in various climates around the world. You had different types of snow climates, you know, from coastal ranges to continental to glacial. There's a whole list of probably 60 or 70 prerequisites that you had to tick off just to apply. And for most people, it's anywhere from a 4 to 8 year process just to become mm-hmm. this guide. And so it's a very strenuous, hard to do, and it's competitive. Every year, like 80 people would apply and only 24 at that time were accepted. And so he had that up against him as well. But again, as his mentor at the time and good friend John Buffery said, what Craig was trying to do in the amount of time that he was trying to do it would be, you know, inhuman, like for anybody even without a family. And Craig had a new child, and his partner Savina was going to school at the time. And Craig said he wasn't too concerned, he could do it. And Buffery said, "I don't doubt it." And I'm like, why didn't you doubt it? He said, "Because it was Craig Kelly." That was his response.
Well, imagine the shock then, I guess, when the whole community learned that he died in an avalanche, when really, I mean, the thing that's so interesting is, and it's about avalanche and it's about the calculated risk. And yet it's looking at this guy who, more than anything, he was smart. And he was calculated and he did his research. And it makes me wonder, I mean, it's not an apprentice's role at all to question the decisions of the guide, who was Rudy Beglinger. But do you think he would have gone into that couloir, I guess it was, that ultimately killed him?
Well, what I did is I went back and I looked at all of the courses he'd been through. I checked his own notes, how he followed along, and the things that would be done in order to evaluate a certain slope. And one of the things that they were told on these apprenticeships or practicums were, hey, when you're following, just make believe that you're in the driver's seat and ask yourself, would I do this? Would I take my clients here for the best snow, the risk, all of these things that he weighed in and out. And by doing that, and then comparing that with past trips that he'd been on and actions he'd been on and places where he had himself with other guides said, nope, don't feel up to doing this. I was able to formulate what I feel is the most probable scenario, what he was thinking when he climbed that. And if there was any sort of a moment where, like, maybe I shouldn't be here. As well, I was able to interview the people, other people who had these moments where they had their own feelings. And I go into great detail of that one guy all of a sudden, for no reason whatsoever, decided I got to get off this slope. But he was in it, and the only way out of it was over the top. And so he started just booking, and he said he had no idea what set him off. So there's this inner spidey sense that I think is in all of us. Another guy had been with Rudy in many times, and he was with the lower group, and he realized, this is closer than I've ever been before to the upper group. Why is my assistant guide taking me here? And he even considered, should I fake a equipment failure to pause? And then they started, and he's like, oh, too late, we'll be good. And so by really going deep into these moments, I feel like it gives the reader the first real look, and also the disaster afterwards, you know, what they had to go through to find, you know, there were 21 of them, and all of a sudden there were 13 people were erased from the landscape. They're looking down, the clock's ticking, and it was up to them to get down the hill into this rubble pile that was massive and try and save some lives. And one of the guys, without giving anything away, and we all know it's about an avalanche, Rick Reynolds was one of the survivors. And he just told me, he said, I looked over the edge right at the crown of the avalanche. And the first thing in my mind was, there's not enough time. There's no way we'll get all of them.
Well, I think, you know, this is the first thing I would like to say, skier, biker, walker, hiker, mountain enthusiast, you're going to love this book. Tell our readers, I mean, what do you want the reader to take away from this book? I mean, I'm taking away so many different things, but I'd love to hear from you, your perspective. You know, what's the biggest takeaway that you want people to walk with?
The absolutely biggest takeaway, and I want everybody in the world to know who Craig Kelly was. I decided to write this book when I was in a lift line in Utah, and a kid looked over at my board in the lift line. I had, this was 15 years after he died. This would have been 6 years ago. And I had a sticker, Craig Kelly is my co-pilot. And he looked down and he said, with all sincerity, who's Craig Kelly? And I realized this 22-year-old kid who looks like he should know, doesn't know. It would be like going to a pickup basketball game and wearing a Michael Jordan jersey and someone saying, who's Michael Jordan? Now, granted, that was a much bigger world, but in our world, in that generation, that's how big it was. So first and foremost, I want everybody to know who Craig Kelly was, because he was an amazing individual and he deserves to have his story told and remembered. The second thing is, when I get into the depth and, let's say, the dark part of the white, I want people to understand and maybe take a second thought. It's a very raw account of an avalanche disaster. And I want people to, when they're deciding to climb up something or ride down something or ski down something, snowshoe in, snowmobile in, whatever it might be, to have a second thought and say, you know, is this worth dying for? If something that could potentially happen happens, what is the terrain? What is the situation? What is the snow doing? And can I go do something else that's still going to give me a great adventure? I want people just to pause, because you hear so-and-so was killed in an avalanche is very different than reading a narrative where you go along on the journey with people who are uncovering their friends. And I don't think it's ever been done before. So that would be the second thing. It's a cautionary story, but it's also a celebration, because Craig lived life like no other. In that 36 years of life, he lived 1,000 years.
Well, fantastic job. And the book is The Darkest White, and you've got to go pick yourself up a copy and read it.
Eric Blem, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Thanks to both of our guests today. Eric Blem, along with National Geographic Adventure of the Year, Mike Lebecki. Boy, that book by Eric Blem is phenomenal. Can't say enough good things about that. Jay and I are both obsessed with it at the moment. You can find our archive shows at kpcw.org under the Shows tab or wherever you get your podcasts.